Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
This is the Donalana Kitchen. We get together here once a week to talk about food, farming, recipes, advice, and opinions. Yes, we do. And we're here at the studios of KHOI Community Radio. We're around our kitchen table. Yes, we have a kitchen table here, and we talk about everything that you can talk about around a kitchen table. Today, we're kind of experiencing fallish sort of weather. The leaves are turning a bit. We got a bit of rain. I happened to stumble onto the Ames High School homecoming parade last night, trumping down Main Street. My goodness, there are a lot of kids in that band. It just took up blocks and blocks. And it was so nice. So that's a thoughts of fall, the high school homecoming parade. And deer hunters are kind of looking around, especially the bow hunters are kind of looking around for a place to put their stands. And it's turning into fall. Yes, it is.
Do you have those nice fat deer?
Yeah, I think there's been.
I even saw a fox in the woods.
Well, good for you.
Woo-hoo. So I think that's the first time I actually ever really saw a fox running.
Isn't that neat?
I know. Oh, I had to double take. I thought I was in a movie for a minute. You know, it's like it was so perfect. I went, really? Fox? Oh my God!
Well, it's something. It's like turning into a fairy tale. Like
yeah,
you should get three wishes or something.
And the fox turned and looked at me.
They do. They
I
do.
Know. It was very, very. Dreamlike.
Dreamlike.
The whole thing.
I ran across the fox in our woods once when I was cross-country skiing. And I was skiing, and you stop, and yes, that's a fox. And the fox stopped and said, yes, that's a human. And we kind of looked at each other
exactly.
For a while. And the whole thing ended when the fox raised his hind leg, peed, and left.
Oh, now, I've seen that with a coyote, but the fox.
Well, I think that was an editorial comment on the part of the wildlife there.
That was his territory.
It was. But today we're going to talk about hardworking souls preparing for winter. We're going to talk about bees. And here is a short thought from Emily Dickinson about bees. To make a prairie, it takes a clover and one bee, one clover, and a bee, and reverie. The reverie alone will do if bees are few. I do like that poem. And we hope that bees aren't few because bees are something we really need. They are hardworking souls. We have a guest today.
Yes, we do. We have Ann Wilbur, who's the mother of Beth, whom we all know and love. That is Isabella Flower Farm.
That's right.
So they have a stall at the downtown farmers market, and Beth's mother, Anne, is the beekeeper. So we are here to talk about bees.
Sounds like a great plan. Sweet, in fact.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And also Beth's mother, Anne, was a third grade teacher in Story City for how many years?
32.
Absolutely astounding.
And she's here to tell the tale today. Yes.
So, and now instead of tending children, she's tending bees.
Yes. So, why bees? How did you get interested in bees?
Well, when you're a gardener, bees become a huge part of your life, not just honeybees, but all the pollinators that show up. And my husband had kept bees years and years ago, and we just kind of got reinterested and started taking
retired
the class.
And you had time again. Right?
I must admit, we did until we took up bees, and now no more time.
Well, but now Beth's Isabella flowers are all grown out at your house. That's
right.
Where the actual farm is.
That's right.
So you've got all of her flowers growing, and then how many hives do you keep out there?
We have about 6 hives out there right now, and we have about 30 hives altogether. We keep a lot of them at the Arboretum.
Oh.
They offered us this, you know, wonderful spot with lots of plant diversity, and so we have a lot there, and then we have them scattered around through Story County and Boone County. In those sweet spots with prairie and other,
very good.
A little protected, you know,
very
from
good.
The chemicals that
we
are out there.
We have a lot of around
we
here.
We do.
Yes.
Well, you were talking about preferences. Bees are quite picky. You'd think that,
absolutely,
okay, they get to live on Elizabeth's flower farm. Now, that must be good for bees. What are they all just happy? What is going on?
Actually, a lot of the flowers that Beth grows are pollen-free because when you cut them and you put them in a bouquet, people don't want pollen falling all over their house. And so her plants, she does a lot of weddings, and a lot of her plants are highly cultivated. They've been modified genetically, and the bees just fly right by them. They're not interested in a lot of her things.
Well, what are they eating out of your house then?
We have a lot of raspberries.
Ah.
And you know, come on, let's leave the weeds growing for the bees, right?
Good.
We do have a lot of other things that I grow that she does not pick that the bees really enjoy. We have a lot of trees, fruit trees, and things like that.
Yeah, you were even saying that some of the flowers, yes, they're beautiful to our eyes, mm-hmm, but they can't even reach the honey bit, or no, the nectar bits.
Right. The bees have a different size tongue than, and like bumbles can pollinate in a completely different way than honeybees do. Mm-hmm. And the native pollinators are designed, you know, their tongue, mouth parts are more designed for what grows here in Iowa, mm-hmm, natively. Mm-hmm. But how much native planting is really left here? So all the pollinators are struggling.
Well, I assume that you're repopulating your weeds with, like, milkweeds.
Yes.
And
we have started some small prairie patches, mm-hmm, and that just every year gets a little bit bigger and a little bit bigger. I've started doing solar kill, so I have plastic sheeting all around, you know, big chunks of it. So next year that will hopefully be a good place to put some prairie plants.
Talk about
that, because we've been having this creeping Charlie conversation.
Well, yeah, and I just got the Iowa Master Gardeners just sent some emails out about it. This is the time. The Iowa Extension Office says this is the time, but ooh, the chemicals they recommend are tough ones. 2,4-D is one.
Oh, right. I don't use any chemicals.
Exactly.
So what is a solar kill?
I take sheets of plastic. I have literally gone down to the local, home store and do-it-yourself stores and buy rolls of 6 mil, and I take landscape staples and I put them in. I put that plastic on as early as I can and let that just sit. And
how long does it take?
The longer the better.
Mm-hmm.
And
a
Creeping
season.
Charlie,
a season, yeah. It,
yes. Mm-hmm. We put in a pollinator garden up in Roland Story with the second graders last year. And July 11th, we put the plastic down. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm, the next May, we took it off and put in the plants. Almost.
Uh-huh. Well, you think of all the various wonderful hardy weed seeds that are underneath it. They can stand
absolutely
a lot.
It's
tough love. It's a tough kill there. Yes, it is.
No matter how you take care of your weeds, the 2,4-D is, to me, the worst way.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of other ways. Plastic, obviously, we're using a resource that
mm-hmm
we would rather not, and it's hard to reuse because the rays really take a toll on that plastic. Mm-hmm. It doesn't often last. That one season is about all you're going to get. There are people who do newspaper, you know, just like the lasagna layers.
Right, right.
But Creeping Charlie is usually a fairly vast space. And I mean, in my yard, and by the way, may I say Creeping Charlie, very popular with the honeybees.
Oh, I would think so.
Just saying.
Oh, shoot. Okay.
There you go.
There we go. Well, and I also noticed that this year I have so much Creeping Charlie that, of course, I hardly have any grass and I haven't had to mow.
Exactly.
Not very often.
There's the bright
once
side.
Once a month, you know, just to keep down the vine plants and the other things that you don't want growing.
Yeah.
But
yeah. Well, thinking of, I often think, I don't keep bees myself, but know a lot of other nice people who do, and I often think bees are livestock, really. We're managing livestock, little bitsy livestock and in huge quantities, but how does one learn how to deal with these things?
Well, a lot of people will try to self-teach using mm-hmm the internet. I, of course, would recommend taking a class, and Andy Joseph, who is our state apiarist, an amazing human being, great beekeeper. And
sounds like fun, actually.
He is wonderful, but there are many classes around the state you can take, and there are websites. You just go on Iowa Bee Classes.
Wait, so how would they find the gentleman you just mentioned?
I personally would just go online and sort
Iowa Beekeepers.
Beekeeping classes, and you'll get to, usually it's the Iowa Honey Producer Association.
Oh, that's right. They are a large group.
Very large group. We're members of that, mm-hmm, as well as the Central Iowa Beekeeper Association. And Andy teaches a class usually in January down in Ankeny, but there are many wonderful teachers across the state. You can learn yourself, but I believe you will enjoy it more and have more success if you have a class under your belt. And the other thing I recommend is a mentor. Find yourself one of those friendly beekeepers that you mentioned, Lana, and tuck them into your back pocket
well,
and call them.
Especially if you're going to be doing as many hives as you're doing.
Even two or three. Backyard beekeepers get pretty intimidated. The first time you pick up a box, 3-pound box of bees, and you go to pour it into a hive, and you're like, I'm pouring bees?
Oh, my.
And you're like, how does this work? And then if the wind is blowing or something.
How does it work?
They just pour.
Bees just go into.
They want to be with that queen. Mm. And the queen is in her separate little queen cage. And if you keep that queen anywhere near them, they won't go anywhere. They're just like glue.
Oh, very good.
So how do you start hive then?
We started by buying packages from California, which is one of the typical places, although there are places around this down across the South. The reason we don't like to get them from the South is the killer bee sort of interbreeding. We worry about a little aggressive bees. But the queen is really what's going to set the tone of the hive over time. And you get a 3-pound box. So that's what we buy. It has a queen in it.
Does it come in the mail?
It does not anymore, although
really?
It used to.
Really?
Back in the 70s.
How does
when
it get there then?
They bring them across in big semi-trucks, and you order them, and they will ship them usually that way. We buy ours actually through Perry. Kurt and Connie Bronnenberg are big beekeepers. They have somewhere between 3,000 to 5,000 hives. It changes over time.
So
I'm not sure.
So you drive down to Perry and pick it up?
We do.
Kind of the bee Walmart there.
By the way, Walmart. There's a semi-truck will pull into Walmart, and you know you're going to meet them at a certain time.
Oh.
And you've already paid for your bees, and you unload your 5 boxes, put them in the back of the car, and off you go. Yeah. It's also done that way.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very good. Very good. And then we see little square boxes as bee homes. That's the thing you purchase too, or do you build those?
Well, my husband builds them, but a lot of people will buy them, and you can buy them knocked down. You can buy them already put together and painted. It's a kind of, it depends.
Why are they white?
You know, I don't know.
Can you make them
colored? Can I just tell you?
I've seen them colored.
My husband, who just likes them white.
Okay.
But there are people who have them, pinks and beautiful, fun colors.
That's what I thought. I'd seen some.
Oh, yes. They're so pretty. I don't think the bees care one bit what color. And in the winter, we do put a black box on them. We do. And that just helps sort of sun, and it also kind of seals them from the wind.
So you mean you set an extra box over the hive in the winter, and it's black?
Oh, very good.
Yes. And they can be cardboard. They can be made of different things. But you don't have to, but we do, just to kind of help seal them up.
Mm-hmm. So you have to kind of make sure the bees have what they need. How do you keep? Well, they have to be warm in the winter. They have to be cool in the summer. How do you do that? Little air conditioners.
They do 100% of that.
Oh, really?
Really. They air condition their own hives. You'll see them out. It's called bearding. You'll see bees just coming out on the front of that. And that's a Langstroth hive, by the way, that we use. It's the box that you're used to. There's also top bars and many other styles of beekeeping.
Okay.
Beehives that people have. But anyway, they'll come out, and it's just some of it is just let's get out of here because our bodies are producing heat and we're trying to keep that hive cooler. They fan it. They bring extra water in and do their own little air conditioning. Water, blow air across it, air conditioner.
Yeah, that's like in the old days before air conditioning.
Like a swamp.
A wet sheet and hang it over the window was the most common.
That's all the bees are doing. And then in the wintertime, they cluster and they make a ball, keeping the queen in the middle. And then they will, if it warms up, it gets to like 40, that ball increases in size, and they just expand it a little bit, keep that temperature. They like to keep it around 90-something.
So they're not warm-blooded, though.
Mm-mm. Yeah,
but they are alive, and they do have heat.
Yes, they do.
So how do they keep it 90 in the middle of the winter?
I wish I knew more of the science. That's when we need my husband here, because I just go, I don't know, they get real close and they cuddle up. No, it's more than that. But they do have a way of connecting their bodies to each other, and they create heat and they maintain this temperature. The science of it eludes me a bit, but it's fascinating. But never, by the way, they do not hibernate. That's just one thing that we often think. Uh-huh. There's no hibernation. They're wide awake. They will fly in the wintertime if the temperature gets 40-ish. They'll be out. They do not poop in the hive, by the way. Quite clean.
Like
tidy
good,
little guys.
Like a very good house
women.
Cat.
Yeah. So if it gets a little warm, they come out and you'll see like little black droppings all around the hive because they just come out and they're called cleansing flights.
Hmm. How many bees are in for one queen? How many bees are in a hive?
A healthy hive in the summer might be, and I'm kind of ballparking 50,000 and up.
1,000?
And in the in the winter, that number goes way down. They kick all the drones out. All the males get kicked out. They don't need them for the winter. And
they just make new drones for next year?
Mm-hmm. She lays.
I won't say anything about that. Okay.
That's right, Donna. Okay. Just hold on to that thought, Donna.
Okay.
So the numbers go way down in the wintertime.
Wow.
But they, you know, we've had them get as small as, you know, kind of a large handful, and that's not really enough to keep warm.
And
those hives
and
often don't make it.
It's always just one queen per hive?
Yes. I mean, I could get into the details of the rare occasion when people do find two, but it's usually a very short term. When they swarm, they basically put the queen on a diet. So this just means they're running out of space.
Okay, running out of space.
And they're like, okay, we've got to take some of us that have to go off and make a new home. So we're going to put our queen on a diet because she cannot fly when she's in her full weight and laying eggs all the time. So they just kind of keep her in a little spot in the hive and they don't feed her and get her nice and thin so she can fly. And they start feeding some of those new eggs, the royal jelly and lots, I'm sure many other ways to make them queens. And they always use, well, I shouldn't say always, often make more than one. Mm-hmm. The first one who hatches, the new young queen, she's a virgin queen. She goes around and kills all the other ones that are still in there. Yeah. And then the original queen takes off with a very large chunk, usually about half
and goes
of the
and
population.
Starts
and they
another
go,
one.
Mm-hmm.
And how long does the queen live?
Oh, back in the day, back in the good old days, we would have a queen and expect her to be successfully laying for up to 5 years maybe.
Oh.
One of our big problems, you mentioned colony collapse earlier before when we were talking, mm-hmm. before we went on air, and I don't consider that really the issue anymore. We have many other problems, and one of them is good queen genetic diversity. Our queens tend to be much more fragile. They don't seem to be bred as often, and as they need to be bred many times, fertilized many times by many drones to be really successful.
And is that because everybody's buying their same bees from that place in California and it's coming on the trucks?
Could be a big chunk of it.
Hmm.
And we're trying to produce so many so fast, and the beekeeping and the beekeepers are demanding a lot. And every year we lose 20 to 50% of our hives, depending on the winter and how well we've prepared them.
You do around here.
We do around here, and I mean that as the state. Mm. Andy Joseph, our state apiarist, does the statistics and comes to a lot of our meetings and gives us the grim news as a community of beekeepers. So our queens are a real issue for us, and we try to replace them every 2 years.
Mm-hmm. How do you replace them?
You go in and you literally pinch the old one out and replace with a new. It's a little more complicated
pinch
than that.
Pinch it out?
It's
I'm called imagining you sticking your fingers in there and
That's
pinching.
Exactly right.
Well,
take a hive tool and squish her.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, it's kind of like pruning a, mm-hmm. a plant to make it better.
She'll stop laying fertile eggs.
Mm-hmm.
She slows down. It's not good for the hive.
Is this part of colony collapse disorder then? Not
again,
sort of less viable queens or something? Are they
colony collapse is a very, very specific situation. It's when the beekeeper would come in and an entire yard would just be gone.
Have you had that happen?
No.
Okay.
Whew. We've seen hives get robbed out. You have a weak hive.
Robbed out?
Right. The other hives in the area will come in, and they get right past the guard bees and go in, and they basically just take all their honey.
Ha.
And sometimes there's a lot of fighting going on, and sometimes it's just...
Is this the same species of bee?
Yes. Yes. It's just they're opportunistic. They need honey. They're going to get it the fastest and easiest way they can. And they go to the door and knock, and if the guard bees aren't tough enough, they walk right in.
The guard bees.
Well, there's so many different jobs. They're morticians. There are bees that are basically assigned to dragging out dead bee bodies and dropping them out.
This sounds like we need a bee sociologist.
Oh, it's amazing. It's one of the most fascinating things I've done, and I've dabbled in lots of silly things. But beekeeping is just forever going to be – you never stop learning.
Never stop. And besides all of the things that can happen just in the bee colony or with another bee colony attacking, are there other predators – the stories of
– the honey bear.
Big bears. Do other predators try to get into the mm-hmm. – into what would
well,
be the, around
like
here?
A skunk will come up
and
at night, you know, and the bees are kind of all tucked in, right?
Mm-hmm.
After dusk, they pretty much go home, and it scratches. And the bees will come out and go, what's going on in that? Skunk just picks them off one at a time.
And eats the bees.
Uh-huh.
Now, what about raccoons?
We've never had much problem, but I've heard other people, raccoons just sort of rustling around. And if they're big enough, I suppose, or if your hive is small enough, could they? I've never had a problem with it. Bears, huge problem. You cannot protect your hives from bears usually.
Uh-huh.
Electric fence, it doesn't matter if they want it. Oh, they will get it.
Okay.
And they
but
devastate.
That's not an Iowa problem.
Actually, Northeast, yes.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I got to say, hallelujah if we have bears.
I kind of feel that
so
way.
Rare.
But if I was a beekeeper in the Northeast part of Iowa, I might not be so happy.
That's true.
It's pretty devastating because they don't just get the honey. They destroy the hives.
Yeah.
So there's nothing left.
Lots of beasties.
They get
like
smarter
honey.
Than the average bear.
But we could talk about varroa mites, which is a pretty depressing. Oh, yeah. By the way, varroa destructor is the scientific name, which I find quite fitting.
Ooh,
probably the biggest challenge.
So this is a mite, mm-hmm. The smallest things are sometimes the most ferocious. There we go.
Yeah.
So talk about that.
They just get right into the hive. They get onto the larvae in the pupa stage, and and it's very difficult to kill them. Unfortunately, we do use chemicals.
I just read the PFI website, let's see, posted something today, was from ISU Extension for small landholders or something like that. I don't know. They didn't call them hobby farmers, but there was a big article on mites, and they talked about several organic methods. And one involved, this sounded really weird, you take a jar, you collect 200 or so bees, and then with the screen over it, and you put powdered sugar in it. Have you heard of that one?
Absolutely. That's the way we test for mites. So you 200 to 300 bees, which, by the way, is about an inch and a half in the bottom of a ball jar.
Oh, how do you get them in the jar?
You just literally take the jar, the lip of the jar, and you really go down the frame, and the bees just tumble in.
Mm. And then you sprinkle the bees with
pour powdered sugar over it, and since they like to be clean, they start cleaning. And by the way, then
they
you shake
themselves in it, yeah.
And then they try to clean that all off, and in the process, the mites come off.
And then you're supposed to shake?
You shake the jar.
The jar and the powdered sugar with the mites in it falls off onto a piece of white paper.
Mm-hmm.
So and the mites are kind of darker colored,
yes.
Right?
Yeah, they remind me of ticks.
Ugh. Oh, my.
That's what they look like. And they're so much larger than you realize. When you see an adult bee with them, you can really see them pinhead size.
Oh, my.
They're very noticeable on a honeybee.
So, and that's something that can really affect production. Does it kill the bees?
It kills the hive.
They're parasitic.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my.
And they also, they put holes in these bees. And so viral, you know, anything can come in and get the bees then. It kind of opens them up for lots of other issues.
Well, I'll send you this link because they talked about, what was it? Some essential oils you can use and some other. Have you tried any of those things?
We don't find that to be really
strong enough.
Effective.
Uh-huh.
Right?
But powdered sugar, who would have thought?
But that's just for testing, right?
Yes, that part is just for testing.
Yeah.
Everyone should be doing that to find out what your mite load is.
Right, and if it's bad enough, then you have to do something about it.
Yes.
So everything from mites to bears. You have a big job ahead of you. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. This is KHOI. Donna Lana Kitchen is Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Welcome back. This is the Donalana Kitchen. We're around the kitchen table talking about bees today. With
it's
us today,
it's a very sweet conversation.
It is. We have Ann Wilbur with us today, and what's so nice about this stuff? Honey, you can eat it.
Well, it's a very old thing. I must say we're talking about you guys spin your own honey, right?
Right, we extract it.
So do you have like one of those stainless steel extractors?
Mm-hmm. We do.
I participated in that once and it was a heavenly experience, I must say. You get sticky.
Oh, yes, you get sticky.
But it's in the air. It's so fine.
Explain what you need to do to get it from beehive to jar.
So we usually get as big a crew as we can because it's a long job. We have many boxes to extract. We take a frame. We cut off the cappings with a hot knife.
Right. How many frames in a hive?
10 or 9, depending on how you're running your hives. But we run 9.
And then what is cutting off the capping?
So when this honey has reached the correct percentage of moisture, which I always forget. It's about 17.5% makes it true honey.
But the bees determine this.
The bees determine that. And by the way, you know, that air conditioning we talked about, they actually fan this honey to dehydrate it, basically. So they have to dehydrate it to the correct percentage. Mm-hmm. They've determined it's really honey now.
The moisture level.
Moisture level is correct. And we have a refractometer to determine it. The bees, they do it their own special bee way. Then they cap it with a very thin layer of wax, beeswax. And then we come along and steal this all from them, all their hard work.
So you lift the frame out, mm-hmm. and you scrape off that top sealant?
Mm-hmm. And it's more melting it. You can scrape it.
Oh.
But we have a hot knife, you know. And it just runs down both sides, and then you put it in the extractor in a vertical position, mm-hmm. and its centrifugal force just does this for us.
So you've got honey.
Flinging. It's like a silly silo.
On the spinner is what do you think? 3?
We have a 20-frame extractor now. We just got it this year, and it's 3 feet in diameter.
Uh-huh.
Approximately.
So because it spins the honey and the honey flies out of the comb and then is collected, it's also in the air.
Oh, everywhere. It's everywhere.
But mm-hmm. it's very fine. So you get slightly sticky and it smells divine.
Oh, it just makes me want to go. Yeah. It's one of my favorite parts of beekeeping, the extraction process.
I think it's a way of getting high. Okay.
It really is.
It's really otherworldly. The time I did it, I also happened to be keeping goats at the same time. So after the honey experience, I went, okay, now I understand in the Bible when it says the land of milk and honey as being like the most fabulous place on earth. I get it.
You were there.
I get it. It's mm-hmm. really an amazing experience to spin the honey out.
It is.
And I have no idea why.
I don't either. And it's just this experience and the flavor and the smell and this literally that stickiness. It's just all wonderful.
I think it does something to your brain as well.
It's a drug.
Well, it is. It must be. And there's another thing too. When bees swarm, the noise that they make, that buzz is also supposed to be. I've forgotten what it's somewhere in an acoustic zone. I forget the Greek. There's Greek numbers for these or letters for these kinds of things, but it does something that really it just calms your mind. It's just amazing.
How nice!
If you have ever stood in the middle of a swarm, that is almost like extracting in the sense that it puts you into another world.
It definitely does.
There are bees everywhere. And I know there are people who would get scared initially, but you shouldn't be. During a swarm, they are
they really don't care about you.
Right, they don't. You're an absolute – you don't even exist as far as they're concerned.
No, and they make a noise.
Yeah. It must be their way of communicating with each other to keep track because it's a very unusual position for them to be in. I mean, they're very vulnerable in a way.
They're homeless.
They are homeless, literally, and they make a little temporary. They'll usually move off – oh, I don't know, within sight of their original hive and sort of cluster.
And they don't really know where
regroup.
They're going to
no,
land.
No, they do not.
It's not like they send somebody out to figure
they
out where
do
they're going.
Once they've left.
Oh.
So they kind of regroup. And they make sure their queen is safe, and they kind of all cluster in. And then the scouts start going out, and they go so far, and they go, okay, well, we've got another spot. And then they go to the new spot and wait, and then scouts wait till they find a home. And I'll have to say, sometimes bees, they don't pick so well. You know, you look at them, and you go, really? You really thought that was a good spot? I just saw a picture. The Des Moines Backyard Beekeepers have a Facebook page, and it literally was under the eaves. It was exterior. You could see
there. So a wild honeybee colony, no, a domesticated colony would do that?
Yes, and they also go find hollow trees, and obviously they find space between the walls of your house and other buildings. Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's more sensible.
Yeah. Well, yeah. That is. Actually, exterior is very rare. I've never seen it before, but high will not survive, of course.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I have read about people who have bees living in their walls, and, mm-hmm. and that sound actually being very soothing to mm-hmm. them. They're really – now, we haven't even talked about eating the stuff.
Okay, let's.
That's really, really amazing. Now, there are other stories, too, like – I think they've found – honey is a preservative.
Absolutely.
They have found honey in the tombs of the pharaohs that is thousands of years old, and it is still edible.
Yes.
Or they've even brought up sunken ships with the amphoras of honey, and when they open them up, it's perfectly edible.
Right.
So you can preserve things in honey. You can preserve flavors in honey, like honey butter or even just – when I had a hive in my backyard, I was also growing our famous rose geraniums. And so I would just stick a bunch of leaves right in the honey. And then about 4 months later or less, you've got rose geranium flavored honey.
I'm going to try that.
It's so good. It's so good. And the leaves that you've put in get kind of crystally, crumbly. If you're a fan of rose geraniums, as I am, that's a marvelous combination.
You could pull them out, let them dry a little bit, and then, you know, crush them up on top of things as a top.
Yeah, I'm holding, what is this, how many ounces? 16 ounces of honey in my hand. So if I put into this maybe even 4 normal size mm-hmm. leaves, it doesn't take much because that essential oil in the rose geranium is very, very potent, and it goes so well. Now, the honey that
Elizabella
honey, okay, which they sell at the farmer's market, this is a very mild multi-flower honey, basically.
In Iowa, it would be really hard to create or produce, have the bees produce anything else, because mm-hmm. where do we find acres of one floral?
Well, the buckwheat.
You have to have a large...
Yeah. Well, the Earl Hafner Early Morning Harvest has, as we were talking about, he has a marvelous buckwheat, which can be had, I think, at Wheatsfield or through Farm to Folk. And it's a butterscotchy buckwheat. Some, like, I've had Eastern European buckwheat honeys that are really dark and really dense. Honey comes in so many, many amazing flavors.
The honey you're holding right there is our spring extraction, and mm-hmm. we have a fall extraction. We have not started. It's still in its gated buckets. We have not started loading, mm-hmm. jars for sale.
What kind of flavor do you
taste? Totally different. This is a mild. This is probably Dutch clover, dandelion, and some of the earlier mm-hmm. floral sources. And then you get into sort of that later in the – we don't do after the goldenrod starts to bloom, because goldenrod is almost bitter and it will crystallize really quickly. We leave that for the bees for the winter, mm-hmm. but the later honey is darker. It's mm-hmm. a gorgeous mm-hmm. amber. I find this rather almost too light. This is actually water white. Mm-hmm. At the Iowa State Fair, they have, I forget how many classes of color, but it's we're judged
water
by
water white is the color.
Water white is one, and then they have white, and I forget, they have, I think, 4 or 5 different, or maybe even more classes mm-hmm. of color, and you're judged, amber is only judged against amber. Mm-hmm. They don't mix all the colors up in the state fair judging.
Well, this would be considered a really marvelous honey for cooking with, because the flavor is not going to interfere. It's very mild flavor.
Exactly.
Delicate, as we would say. Very delicate flavor.
I used it. I made some shortbread and used it with rosemary, and it lets everything talk. very nicely. It doesn't overpower anything. Buckwheat, on the other hand, would be a completely different kind of honey to cook with.
Yeah, you have to really include that in your flavor profile and enhance it and fool with it, you know?
It makes a difference what blossom bees are getting their nectar from.
Absolutely.
So there has been a wonderful bloom of garlic chive flowers at my place. Will the honey taste like chives?
I don't believe so.
Oh, well, I hope not. But anyway,
you could stick the garlic chives in the honey.
Oh, I think that'd be wonderful. An onion-infused, garlic-infused honey.
But not if you were expecting something that didn't taste like garlic.
Right, you wouldn't want that in your cookies. No. But it would have interesting uses. I did want to say, if you are baking and you want to substitute honey for sugar, there are a few things you know. You can do it freely. However, honey is generally sweeter than sugar, so if your recipe calls for sugar, you may want to reduce it at least 25%, but do it by taste. You know, you just need to do that. You also have to reduce the liquids in the recipe. Now, if the only liquid is egg, you can reduce egg because honey does have some binding qualities to it. And then a small rule of thumb is to lower the oven temperature by maybe 25 degrees because it will burn a little more easily.
And that's one I had never heard of. I'm glad to know that.
You're listening to KHOI. This is the Donalana Kitchen, and I want to mention that you can find out more about the Donalana Kitchen, more about this radio station, and go to our webpage. You can find the Donalana Kitchen webpage there at khoifm.org. Go to the talk section, go to the Donalana Kitchen section, and you can find archives, you can find recipes, and you can find recipes for Donna's
honey butter. Is in the archive.
This is the Donalana Kitchen. I want to share a poem with you. I've got, we'll talk about honey, more honey, of course, in a little bit. I ran across a good book here at the Ames Public Library called 99 Voices, 99 Lives, County Poems of Iowa. A man named John.
Isn't that an Iowa book, right?
Yeah. John David Thompson, a poet who lives in Pella, Iowa currently. He took on the task of writing a poem for each of Iowa's 99 counties. And they're lovely. They have Iowa history in them. This is a poem, his poem about Clark County. And it's about rural schools. It's called Rural Schools Coming Down. Tales about them seem to stretch like old porch boards, with each telling a parent, a grandparent, the distance never spoken with great or long as precedents, but regalers' hands reaching from living to dining room partitions. Snow was ankle-deep to knee-deep to waist-deep in a tone of a nostalgic moan. Somewhere in the testimony, looking for respect and pity. You kids today just don't know how good you have it. They're becoming extinct, you know, not the kids, but the one-room makeshift rural schools. Like the one in Clark County, aligning 12 townships, presided over by a schoolmarm known as Dame, who had the strictest parents, the PTA. She had to be home by 8 p.m. unless poised at a school function. Her petticoat was doubled, not her salary, which was often provision pay in the form of corn, flax, oats, hay, brick, iron, and other farm product wage. Dame was not to keep the company of men, ride in their vehicles, unless they steered with the license of brother or father. She stoked the fire at 7 a.m. daily, so the children reaped warmth from first-hour frost. Miss could not marry, leave town, let her hair down without permission, or loiter in the town's ice cream shops. Completion of eighth grade was important, a test of attendance, acumen, state requirements, penmanship, a skill of study. History wasn't a course. It was in the making. You would never forget it. Toilets lined with cakes, a washstand gurgled outside the hall. No security checks, study periods, passes, or open hours. A flag, a pump, no separate desks. Sticks between logs wedged into the structure side. Sticks with planks for inkwell. Buttonhooks, pen knives, basket-shaped lunchboxes. So many of them are coming down, rural schools, coming down like Sunday morning in the Kris Kristofferson ballad. Some by erosion, atrophy, storm, the legislative plow, a depreciation, unappreciated. I guess I was born too late, rural school. I'd like to keep you upright, preserved, give you a hand, best belle of the land. Aw, shucks, just my luck. I flip an Iowa quarter in midair of despair and wait an Arbor Day minute, tails, reverse side, not the hog, cow, corn or bean, but you, rural school, the foundation of the state's pride. There, unstretchable tail in minted silver in your hand.
We have our Ames Rural School. Isn't it preserved out on the Meeker School ground or
yes,
something?
Yes, it is. Yes, it
What's
is.
It called?
Hogarth School.
Hogarth School. Mm-hmm.
That's rural school coming down. And you were a school teacher for ages. I certainly hope you didn't cause any fluff by appearing untowardly in the ice cream parlor.
Well, I might have been seen in the ice cream parlor a time or two, but
yes, you might have.
Not in the local tavern.
There you go. Yes, we hold our teachers to high esteem. And now, instead of herding students, you are herding bees. Let's talk more about honey.
Well, now, at your farmer's market stand, you have creamed honey that you make yourself. Tell me how you do that.
We just started this, so we've made our third batch, so I would hardly call us experts, but Beth gave me the proper term. You know, me, I have this tendency to want to tell you how to make the watch, not just what time it is. So she tries to make sure I keep it simple. It is controlled crystallization.
Ah, controlled crystallization. Okay. And this kind of thickens it and makes it cloudy.
Exactly. And the crystals should be so small that you almost can't sense them with your fingertips. If you rub some of this between your fingers, you really
don't. No, it's
don't.
Not like when the honey crystallizes in the jar and you have to put it in the warm water to melt
right.
it. Right. So how do you control the crystallization?
We take it, and unfortunately, I say unfortunately because some people don't want us to heat the honey at all. We heat it to 130 degrees, which is not going to kill the pollen or do any of that kind of damage to the honey. But the honey you're looking at right here has not been heated at all mm-hmm. over what the bees obviously have mm-hmm. done. But we take this honey to 130, and then we cool it down to room temperature, and we add some already creamed honey. Now, here you get into that, what came first, you know, the chicken or the egg? How did somebody control the crystallization the first time? Huh. We literally take a pound of this crystallized, already crystallized mm-hmm. honey, creamed honey, and put it in that 10 pounds of cooled, but had been warmed the day before. Stir it all up, put it in the containers. We put it at 57 degrees, 3 to 10 days, we have this lovely firm, almost butter firm,
mm-hmm.
at room temperature.
57 degrees.
Yes.
It's more of a spreadable.
Very much so.
Yeah. We talked about Donna honey butter, which was adding butter and honey together, but this is more of a butter texture, but it's honey, just honey.
There is literally nothing but honey in this.
Ah.
And once you've made it crystallize that, it just maintains that?
Yes, it does. You can refrigerate it, but there's no need to. We keep ours on the counter at room temperature. And it, you know, this is the kind of thing that would last forever, but over time, will this creamed honey change a little bit in consistency? It might. It would still be totally safe. You could warm it up and turn it back into liquid honey if you wanted. Mm-hmm. It is just honey.
And how do you get it at precisely 57 degrees for 3 days?
We have bought wine coolers. I just think that's comical. So the ones we had to buy do not have compressors because a compressor, you know, the temperature varies a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
These are all just you plug them in, and I don't know how this works, but it works. And we just plug them in and keep it at 57 degrees.
All of this to just get creamed honey.
Yes.
Well, sounds wonderful.
It is wonderful.
And you mentioned this is different than as you use honey in your kitchen, you don't use it for a while, regular honey will crystallize. Is that because it's hitting the air, or why does it crystallize?
It's a natural process of honey, and I'm not really sure exactly why, but I do know certain floral sources will crystallize faster. I said goldenrod will crystallize quite quickly. I've heard in Canada where they have fields of canola, they can't even get the hives out of the fields before already crystallized in the hive.
Oh, my.
So certain plants must have the nectar, and for some reason, will crystallize faster than others.
And of course, you can still eat it when it's crystallized. But I found that, again, you can warm the honey a little bit, and it turns back into liquid honey.
So, I would like to just caution, never microwave it if you care about the health benefits or the natural part of this honey, because that will just damage the pollen.
You sell yours completely raw.
Right. But if you microwave it, that's obviously not healthy for the honey. I would put it in a hot water bath and let it just take time to.
Very good. What's your favorite honey recipe? What do you like?
A spoon?
A spoonful
of honey makes the medicine go down, right?
My favorite is winter coming on. And normally I just like my tea just plain. But especially if I'm feeling a little off, a nice cup of Earl Grey tea has to have a nice teaspoon of honey. Somehow it just has to. And that's a winter thing. I think of that often. That's one of my favorite things. Also, I just like honey on a good piece of bread with butter.
Well, and I think that's why I like to do the honey butters. Mm-hmm. I have to say, my mother had a specific old kind of crock that I can still visualize, and she used to make honey butter. It's one of my earliest sort of primal, and I'm sure all she did was mix softened butter with plain honey, you know, that simple, not like even flavored or anything, but it is a honey butter on toast.
Very good.
I mean,
very good.
How about comb honey? I mean, you don't really cook with it, but I love it on my toast, and I eat the comb and all in that situation.
That's true. Yes, you have a little chewy bits.
Chew on it for a while. Are you able to get any of the other products out of your, like, propolis or?
We do not propolize. We do not trap the propolis. That's actually how they do it. You put a little trap on the hive entrance, and as the bees are in and out.
So does that mean
pollen. I apologize. That's a pollen trap. Propolis, you know, I don't know. Do you have to go in and scrape it off?
You might have to.
I have never actually read anything or talked to anyone who is collecting propolis. That is the stickiest product. I mean, honey is sticky. Propolis.
What is propolis for? What is that?
Well, herbally speaking.
Oh, it's medicinal.
It has a tremendous. What are the bees? It's an antibiotic for the bees,
absolutely.
Right? It's
absolutely.
Their own natural antibiotic. So, for example, you can buy propolis lozenges for having a cold.
That's what
or
that comes from.
Or you can have a propolis tincture. Or
that's where that
it's
comes
very
from.
Strongly flavored. You can sometimes buy a natural, the scrapings, I guess, off the hive. It's kind of a tarry-looking substance.
You could seal your ship with it. I was joking, of course, but it is that sticky. Mm-hmm. It's tar-like.
Oh, and it has a very distinct flavor mm-hmm. that, you know, once you've experienced a miraculous healing from it, it doesn't taste bad at all. So propolis. Now, royal jelly is another thing that's highly coveted. But how do you do that? Don't know.
Do not know that one.
See, there are so many mysteries yet to be solved. And bees, if they need a little help from us to have a good environment to work in. But it sounds like they work their little butts off for us.
So your pollen is not collected. Yours goes right into the honey.
When we spin it out, there's always some pollen that they have stored in with the honey.
Mm-hmm.
And that just goes right into it. And the little filter we use is, it reminds me of the stainless filters you might use if mm-hmm. you were just using it instead of a tea infuser. Mm-hmm. It does not filter out any particle, big particles. I'm having trouble saying that. Bee parts, because there are bee parts, you know,
yes.
that are in there. Somebody died and left a bit.
A leg or a, mm-hmm. a wing or a...
That's all we're taking out.
Because according to some people who do natural medicines, if you're having local allergies and you start to vary in small quantities, mm-hmm. consume local honeys with the pollen in it, you will begin to develop an immunity.
I've had people call me and ask for mm-hmm. a hive in their backyard to do that. We've never figured out quite how you would open that hive and get those bees in the wintertime, you know, because it's anywhere from 1 to maybe 20 stings that mm-hmm. they're looking for, I guess, a day or maybe not every day. But mm-hmm. so we've never really wanted to get into.
Oh, to have the bees actually sting them.
Mm-hmm.
That's supposed to work. Oh,
mm-hmm. That's
because
what
you
do.
Can buy mm-hmm. you can... bee pollen and eat it.
Mm-hmm. And what about... I hate to call it venom, but is that what you would call it? Can you give yourself a shot of that?
Now, is that... I don't know. Because some people have anaphylactic attacks
mm-hmm.
from
yeah.
different bees. I don't know. I'm
lots
a little over
learn.
My head here.
Mm-hmm.
It's a complicated and multifaceted and endlessly interesting subject.
Thanks to Ann Wilbur for being with us today. We've been talking about honeys. What a sweet thing, and what a gift. What a gift from a little bit of livestock that we can learn to work
yeah,
with.
Now I have really sticky fingers.
And Donna's been eating, honey. It's been good. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. There's a lot of things coming up this weekend.
Yes, some busy bee things happening.
Yes, Maximum
town.
Ames, Weeksfield Customer Appreciation Day, Central Iowa Barn Dance, Sunday, Octagon Art Festival. Yes, all sorts
oh,
of things
this coming
happening.
Sunday.
Yeah, all
oh,
sorts
hallelujah.
Of. So you won't even be home. And there's something called the Tiny Fest in Colfax, Iowa. Mm-hmm. Tiny Fix, Colfax, Iowa, Jasper Kearney Fairground, tiny houses. Look into that.
Oh,
yes,
that will
you
be
do.
Fun.
All right. Support this fine community radio station. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. If you'd like to contact us, go to khorradio@gmail.com. Put Donna Lana Kitchen in the headline there and tell us what's on your plate. Today we heard Scottish music from the group Local Hero from their CD called Peace and Plenty. Oh, we could use more of that. Peace and plenty. Yes. Enjoy honey. Enjoy fall. Enjoy Iowa. My name is Lana Nachtigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas with very sticky fingers mm-hmm.
oh,
today.
Engineering by Evan Taylor. Eat good food and enjoy life.
Funding for KHOI comes in part from the Octagon Center for the Arts, bringing you the Octagon Art Festival with original artwork, live entertainment, and a variety of food. Information is available at octagonarts.org. That's octagonarts.org.